to explore it. I'm your host, Paul Torta. Today, we welcome Tom Choate. Tom came to Alaska in the 1950s exploring and climbing. He was the first ranger naturalist in Mount McKinley National Park, now Denali National Park, climbed Denali almost every decade since 1963, and has a wealth of experience to share. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media.
Welcome to the show, Tom.
How do you do? I'm an old fan of this particular program. I've been listening to you for, it seems like, more than 30 years.
Well, hopefully not that long, but yeah,
at least the explorers.
Yeah. Tom, we're just thrilled to have you here. Tom, has been at this longer than anybody I know and most people that I don't know. And so I think we have so much to talk about. It's like we're talking about maybe two or three shows worth of lessons learned and history from Tom. Tom, why don't we start with how, as a youth, how did you get into the outdoors? What was your inspiration?
Well, actually, I can't tell you exactly when it was, but I blame it largely on my grandfather, who came out in the early days to California and managed to make enough money out of hardware, because there were lots of miners, but they had to be sold shovels and axes and all of that kind of thing. And it turns out my grandfather was a manager of a hardware company in Sacramento and had enough money to zoom up to Lake Tahoe before there was any highway around it. You got there by train, and he found this little shoreline place and bought a couple of lots back in 1904.
Wow.
And he started building a cabin and all of that kind of thing. So my mother spent some time up there. And then when I was born, I spent some time up there. And I can't tell you when it all started, but I sure liked it in the Sierras.
And what year were you born?
I was born in 1934.
Excellent.
In fact, they must have been feeling pretty comfortable to have me in the middle of the Depression.
Yeah, yep. And what, so you started off in Lake Tahoe, and then what about college and education?
Well, I started out thinking a little bit about liberal arts and quite a variety of things, but I was always interested in the outdoors, and I'd gotten into the Boy Scouts, and we went up into the Sierras in the summertime, and I had a friend who was really a mad fisherman, and he got me started on fisheries, and we would go into the backcountry and chase down golden trout and all of that kind of thing, you know, far, far from the end of the trails. Well, that made me think quite a little bit about biology, particularly the fisheries side of it. And then I went to the university, and they were having a huge liberal arts activity going on, and then the professors were in a loyalty oath battle with the government. They were witch hunting for commies and all of that kind of thing around. It's like, this is really weird. And then the guy that I wanted to study under moved over to San Francisco State, so I followed and ended up doing a year of exploration and liberal arts and all of that type of thing. And that summer, I worked in the Sierras.
Uh-huh.
For the Forest Service. It's like, wow, this is, I've been missing this. It's been kind of fun being a bohemian, but I think it would be even better maybe to have a lifetime up here. And there were a whole lot of stories about reading John Muir and whatnot, who had a philosophical influence on me too. So I searched around the mountains and decided that that was a more important thing to me. And so I ended up going to Colorado to get a degree in wildlife management. I was just a little bit early. They had a university pop up about 2 years after I needed it in Humboldt in California.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But it didn't exist at the point I really needed it. And I had to go to college because they were drafting every single person, every single male at least, in my high school class to go to be shot at in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a big influence on my going to Colorado and also on my going to Alaska.
Yeah. So let's go to Alaska then. What happened there? How did you get to Alaska?
Well, the thing is that my second year in this wildlife and forestry course required a summer camp.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to summer camp, and we had a great time learning all these outdoor skills and how to be a scientist in the woods and all of that type of thing. And then all of a sudden the courses were over and it was August and I needed quite a little bit of money to get through the year and to avoid being drafted. I promised them that I would be an officer's candidate if they let me go to college. So I had to go back where I got drafted. And so there was a fellow in the school whose uncle was running Caterpillar tractors for a construction outfit in Alaska, and he made this unheard of rate of $20 an hour.
Wow.
Well, at that particular point in time, the average wage for me would have been about 85 cents, possibly a dollar if I had a really good job.
Yeah.
So anyway, it sounded like, oh, the same story that so many people have been fooled about Alaska. If you go up there, you can get rich.
Well, it ain't true, I can tell you.
I didn't make enough money.
Yeah.
And I'd fallen in love with Alaska before I ever came here, reading John Muir and Arctic Wild and a few other such things.
Yeah.
And then when I saw the real thing, it's like, this is incredible. I got to figure out how to stay here. And it turned out we were having ourselves in deep trouble in North Korea. And they all were concerned about the Russians coming to Alaska. And they said, well, you know, if you volunteer here, you get to stay here and get trained with the Alaska natives and all of that. And I said, me? So I spent two more years here.
Yeah.
And the Russians didn't come. And we went out and played ski troops and all of that Alaska game, which was very interesting. And meanwhile, I figured out how to find salmon and how to find moose and other such things because I was still fish and wildlife oriented.
So talk about that. So you were with the National Guard, is that right?
No, it was the Army.
The Army?
Yep.
And you were out in the, bush? Were you doing, what was it?
Well, I was right here in Fort Richardson, we were in a reconnaissance unit, which meant that And that was appropriate because most of the natives, they knew their way around Alaska, and people brought in from somewhere else didn't have a clue. And they helped to teach me a little bit about it, too, of course. And I wanted to go for the more athletic thing, so I volunteered for the biathlon team and that sort of thing. And I just generally had a chance to get acquainted with it. And later on, I got into mapping and aerial photographs and discovered all of these special ways of finding my way into the wilderness.
That's great. So this was 54, is that right?
54, 55, and 56.
Wow. So, yeah, we'll talk about change later in the show, but boy, there's a lot of change that's happened up here since then.
Yeah, well, it was amazing before it was a state and before the big oil and whatnot. It was quite a different thing as a territory. And as it started developing into a state, it changed radically.
Yeah. So when you think back at that time period, let's just talk about that. How would you describe like Anchorage in particular? Was it wild? It was obviously starting to grow.
If I had been dedicated to climbing mountains, which I wasn't at that particular time, I probably could have gotten on top of all sorts of things that nobody ever bothered to look at before, other than maybe a few sheep and goat hunters.
Yeah. Were there, I always heard that there were caribou in the Tourettes. Does that ring a bell at all? I mean, that Jimmy Haffey talks about finding caribou antlers up there. And
it's possible. Yeah. I know that they were on the Kenai.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't verify anything more than that.
Yeah, interesting. It just seems like I've always wondered why there weren't more caribou or any caribou up there. And one theory was always that, they hunted them all out at one point. And development, you know, the Glen Highway and sort of cutting them off from the Talkeetnas.
But remember that young males of everything, whether they be mountain goats or whatever, go exploring.
Yeah.
Mountain goats are typically coastal and mountain sheep are typically interior. And they kind of overlap in places like Turn Lake and around Girdwood and whatnot. But mountain goats have been seen venturing all the way to Denali.
Oh, wow. I've never heard that. Yeah.
And, you know, young males are out hunting for things, and it happens. They found a wolf all the way down into California. Things have been changing, and it's usually the young males.
This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordock. I'm here with Tom Choate talking about his decades and decades and decades and decades of exploring Alaska. Let's talk about, so you were in the military, then you, I didn't believe, became the first naturalist ranger in Denali, is that right, in the 50s, late 50s?
I had two very interesting experiences as soon as I got out of the military, because I wanted to pursue my career, and the military had made it possible for me to go back and start and finish my studies, and that would have been back down in Colorado, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity in Alaska. So the first summer, I was still interested in fisheries, and so I worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service. There was no fish and game. That was not a state yet.
All right, yeah.
So the fish and game people didn't exist in their current sense, but the Fish and Wildlife had to do a lot of that kind of work. So I wanted to be a biologist, so I was on a weir over in the valley. And that was all very good because I could watch the trout going up and try to identify all the fingerlings going down the river and, you know, count them and all of the sort of things that good biologists do. And then one day, a person had quit or something or other, and the boss called up and said, look, you're off in the middle of the day between your shifts there. Would you go up to Big Lake and check on fishing licenses and stuff because our guy is not available? So I dutifully went up there and went out. There was some guy fishing in the middle of the lake. And so I dutifully went over to him and said, sir, can I check your license? And he looked at me with an angry sort of a face. And he put his hand on his hip where there was a bulge and said, yes, you can see my license if you can beat me to the draw. And then, of course, I got a feeling for what early Alaska was really all about. And before I got away from the Fish and Wildlife Service, I even got shot at because I was trying to protect some salmon and somebody else was greedy and wanted them.
Wow.
And that's a little bit like the old days in Alaska where people came up here to get away from regulations and get away from the government, and they didn't appreciate anybody like me
trying to be a good soldier and do my duty.
So that then led to the Denali pig?
Well, actually, what it did was it said, you know, I don't think I want to be in fisheries anymore. Let me look a little better at national parks and a little bit more into the wildlife side of things. And so that's where I changed my approach. And the first thing I did was to apply to Denali because I was already in love with the mountain, although you couldn't get there except by train.
Yep.
And so the next summer, I was absolutely blessed to be the one chosen. I only had my 2 years. Well, by then I had 3 years of a wildlife degree. But to be able to beat out the others and become the first ranger naturalist in the park was absolutely amazing. It was 1957. In 1957, they first opened the Denali Highway, and the first car ever drove by itself to the park.
Wow.
Before that, if you wanted a car, you had to be rich enough to put it on a flat car and send it to Denali. And the rest of the visitors came in the regular passenger cars and got in on the few buses that we had and got taken out into the park.
Yeah.
It was kind of a blessing, though, because originally everybody that came on the train would almost be forced as a captive audience to come and listen to me talk about the history of Denali and then run like crazy over to the dog team so that I could be over there when the tourists showed up after lunch.
Yeah.
I got to run the dog team around, and then I had to zoom down to the evening program, and I had all these different jobs, which they have different people to do today, but I was just me, just alone. And then one day, about middle of June, it seems to me, the first car came through, and I got to greet it, welcome to Denali. And I hadn't realized, of course, at the time, what a problem it was going to turn into.
Yeah.
But it didn't really get to be too big of a problem because there wasn't such a volume of vehicles until quite a bit later in 1971 or thereabouts when the first car came along the highway, the present Parks Highway, which meant that large outpourings from Anchorage as well as Fairbanks didn't have that extra 150-mile drive to come and see us.
Yeah, for those listeners not familiar, the Parks Highway didn't really get put in until the early 70s, so the only way to get to Denali was on the train or from Fairbanks or via the Denali Highway. So not easy to get to. So that was a pretty special time up there. So how many years did you do that?
I basically did it that one summer. Yeah. But I had gotten so many crazy experiences that summer. And, of course, the other problem was that I tried to pretend a little bit too much. It's a tendency I've always had because I've been in a position to have to lead or lecture about something that I didn't always know a lot about. And here's this kid with a bit of California and a bit of Colorado and not very much Alaska experience. He's trying to do all of the jobs in the park.
Yeah.
And the dog sledding was a great example because I sort of memorized all of the things that I was supposed to say. And I learned a little bit about the dogs all during that particular summer.
Yeah.
But I remember one day realizing that several of the people in my audience knew more about it than I did. And some of the things I'd say, you'd sort of detect a little bit of a frown.
Uh-huh.
And then one person who turned out to be an ex-official.
Yeah.
Who'd lived around Denali for a while. He was polite enough to wait, and he came up afterwards to me, and he said, "Young man, you know, it wasn't really quite like that."
Yeah.
So anyway, I had that kind of experience, and I spent every weekend trying to learn more. And the park allowed me to take out cameras. So I would go out and try to take movies of wildlife and a variety of things of that nature. One weekend, I got to go out with a bear biologist. He was fundamentally a professor from Fairbanks who spent his summer studying the bears up there. And he was helping to teach me about it. And I carefully memorized all the things that I wasn't supposed to do. You know, if the bear charged me, I wasn't supposed to run and all of that kind of thing. Well, the only problem with all of that is that you have to override your natural instincts with a little bit of brain power.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out we're out at Sable Pass, and we saw this sow and her cubs coming down a valley in a very nice position where if we climbed up a hill, we could see what exactly it was that they were eating. So as soon as she got pretty much behind the hill, we zoomed across the valley and climbed up on top. Meanwhile, unknown to us, the bear and her cubs decided to go up the hill on the other side instead of continue down the valley. Well, we arrived together at the summit. And fortunately, the cubs were behind the mom.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And she was so surprised that she sort of retreated toward her cubs in shock. And I was so shocked that I found myself coming back down from about 2 feet in the air, facing away and starting to run.
Yeah.
And I looked over my shoulder and said, "Whoa, I wasn't supposed to do that." And I looked and I saw her turning away. And it's like, boy, I was sure spared.
Yeah. That's a great story. Well, you know, I know you as a hiker and a mountaineer, and I want to sort of get into that a little bit. This is Outdoor Explorer, and here's Paul Torlett. We're talking with Tom Choate. Tom, when I know you started your climbing in the '60s. Talk us through that. What was the progression?
Climbing actually started in high school.
Okay.
And the thing was that when I went to a large high school, I was still a pretty small guy when I got into high school. I was the second smallest in my junior high school. It took a little while for the hormones to kick in, I guess. So there I was, too short for basketball and too lightweight for football and too slow for track. And I would look and see all of the athletes. They're the ones that had all the girls. And it's like, you know, I've got to find some kind of sport. What can I do? What can I do? And one day along came the Sierra Club and said, "We're offering a free mountain climbing course up on the rocks." And it's like, "Well, yeah, I got to go try that." So I got halfway up one of these rocks and I realized that the guy climbing the rope alongside me was one of these jocks that had all of the girls, and he was more scared than I was. And I said, "Oh my goodness, maybe I found my profession."
Nice.
And so I got started relatively early on. I had chances to go up and explore Yosemite And so I learned a little bit about climbing back in the 1950s. And then I learned a whole lot more in Colorado.
Yeah.
I did my first winter ascent of Long's Peak in February of 1954.
Wow.
And so it's like, okay, yeah, this is a really great place. And in 1957, for example, in Denali, I started poking around some of the peaks. And
yeah,
I did have a look at a couple of... I made probably two first ascents at that particular time, and also had a chance to see the surge of the Muldrow Glacier, which was extremely exciting.
Yeah, you told me a story the other day about sleeping. You want to talk through that?
Yeah.
Sleeping through the surge. And so you've seen both surges now, too. You saw that one, you saw the more recent one.
It's just come again, yeah. Yeah. I'm lucky that I might be one of the few people that's seen both of the surges of the Muldrow Glacier. At that time, we'd had a... rumbling along the fault line, the Denali fault line had moved, and the main glacier as it comes down off of Mount McKinley is the Muldrow, and it follows the fault line. So the normal thing and the logical thing was to say it was the movement along the fault line during the earthquake that upset the glacier and caused all of this surging.
Now, this is in 53.
And this was in 1957 when I was there as a ranger.
Yep, yep.
And I went out with one of the geologists who was studying this and looking at all this. And we went up along the glacier and where you previously had been able to walk off the tundra onto the ice without too much of a trouble. It was pretty stagnant. That area had towers about 250 feet tall. And because they were being pushed, they were falling down every single day. And ground would shake and you'd hear all of this roaring and whatnot. And it was absolutely spectacular. But we were quite a long way up. We were two-thirds of the way at least to the corner where it turns for Anderson Pass. And so we better spend the night, you know. So Saturday night it was, because it was my day off. And it's like, okay, try to sleep. Well, we're easily 150 yards away.
Yeah.
And up on the moraine, almost even with the top of these falling over seracs during the night... You know, in the summer, it's pretty light, and I would finally get my eyes closed and start dreaming, and then the ground would shake. And
yeah.
All this noise, and then I'd try to sleep again, and I start dreaming, and I'm dreaming that this glacier is running over me. And you can feel the shake, and you can feel the rumble, and it's like most extraordinary. I didn't get any sleep, but it was an amazing night.
That's wild. Yeah, and then you saw it again recently, right?
Yeah, well, I had the chance to go out into the park and have a look at that surge and see how similar it was to the situation there. And a lot of people have been predicting that they'll be able to climb up on the Muldrow Glacier again fairly soon.
Uh-huh.
But I want to remind them that I wanted to climb Denali in 57. It was impossible. We thought about it in 58, thought about it in 59, thought about it in 60. All of those years, it was impossible to get through all of the crevasses. It wasn't until 1962 that anybody even tried.
Wow.
And those people got stuck on the highest ice fall fairly far up. So they kind of wound their way through and got started. And that stimulated my marvelous partner from Colorado.
Yeah.
Turned out to be one of Alaska's most famous mountaineers, Vin Homan.
Yep.
Stimulated him to reschedule our climb for 1963. And so I returned to Denali in 1963 and did this incredible traverse that was full of all of the wonderful inventions of Vin Homan.
Yeah.
And it contained such things as we'll get up on top when the sun is eclipsed. And we will also try to sleep on top and be the first people ever to sleep on top. And we're not going to have airplanes drop us anywhere. We're going to do it like the pioneers and start walking from Wonder Lake and end up all the way down the glacier on the other side in Kantishna. We're going to make the first crossing.
Yeah.
And so we had all of these ambitions, and most of them came true.
Did you sleep on top?
I wasn't in a position to do so, and in fact, we made some huge mistakes. We added a new person,
mm-hmm.
and he was more of a runner, very good marathon sort of a runner, but not so much of a climber. Mm-hmm. And I was the person on the rope with him. Mm-hmm. So he was the fit guy, and all of them had been running the marathon in Seward in preparation for this trip. Uh-huh. And so they were all super fit from the week before on Mount Marathon, and there I was coming from having finished the writing of my thesis and sitting on my tail all spring, uh-huh. trying to keep up with them. So it was a little bit of a disaster, and by the time we got up to about 15,000 feet, it turned out that Cliff got sick, and I had to stay with him. I didn't feel all that well myself because we'd taken a pretty short amount of time to get up there.
Yeah. Huh. Then, you made it.
Yeah, well, this is where we were very lucky to survive because we knew very little about the altitude sickness at that sort of point. And after making an attempt to follow the sourdough's route by going straight up from the upper part of the glacier onto the North Peak, they ended up getting into a little bit of altitude sickness up at about 18,000 feet, and because they were also pushing it a little bit. They were substantially fitter than I was. And so they decided they would come back down and go up to Denali Pass, and then we'd have a little bit more time to get acclimatized and whatnot. Well, there was Cliff, who was still altitude sick. What did we do? We went up almost 3,000 more feet up to Denali Pass.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah.
And, of course, you're supposed to go down, not up.
Yeah.
And remember, this was in the days before radios, before satellites. The pilot would come over once in 2 weeks and maybe drop us something to eat.
Uh-huh.
There was no, you know, had he started dying of altitude sickness, which he should have, because we went up, not down.
Yeah.
What would have happened?
Yeah.
But he would have died on us.
Yeah, but he didn't.
But somehow or another, it's one of those cases my wife says I dodged another bullet. Somebody should have died, and it didn't happen.
Yeah. That's great.
That allowed us to go on up and bag the mountain and do some stuff later on.
Yeah, and did a traverse.
Yes, sir.
This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. I'm on Alaska Public Media. I'm talking to Tom Choate about his many, many decades of climbing. We just finished up a story of his first attempt of at least four on Denali. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more with Tom.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
All right, we're back. This is Paul Tordak with Outdoor Explorer. I'm with Tom Choate, and you're listening to Alaska Public Media. So, Tom, before the break, we're talking about your first Denali climb. It sounded like quite something. But you went, then you took a break and went to New Zealand and Africa and did more climbing there. That sounds like a whole other show. We're going to focus on Alaska here. And so you came back, and you had a thing. You climbed Denali for about every decade up until recently.
Well, you know, I fell in love with the place, and there were also, I discovered many, many sides of it with different characters. As you go up the Muldrow, you get one sort of a feeling, and as you come down on the west side, where most people fly into these days, and down the Kahiltna, it has a very different sort of a character, and of course it's sunny. Sometimes it can be quite hot. And you end up getting in trouble because there's crevasses that you could fall into, and yet it's 70 degrees and the sun is reflecting off the snow and you're getting totally sunburned. And if you want to strip down and be cool, you're likely to get even more sunburned. And so that's one of the problems that is so particularly noticeably different, at least for me, on that first trip on the south side. And then because we were trying to do this in the purest sort of way, we had an airdrop of some food, climbed on Mount Hunter, made some first ascents on Mount Hunter, and then ended up walking the whole way. It's a 55-mile-long glacier. And we walked all the way down to the end, scrambled through the willows and alders and things in the Dutch Hills and Peters Hills, and finally got to the first human being that we'd seen in 6 weeks. Huh. And his name, he died relatively soon because he was one of the original Gold Rush people.
Uh-huh.
From the early 1900s Gold Rush there in the Dutch and Peters Hills. His name was Rocky Cunningham. And, of course, that place was not accessible by road, although there was a little road where they could bring stuff up from barges on the Susitna.
Uh-huh.
So we walked down that road until we got to this edge of the Susitna River, another 30 miles or so after seeing this first human.
Uh-huh.
It was quite an amazing connection. And then we got down to the river, and then we jumped around and hopped around and waved our arms for hours. Finally, somebody over on the Talkeetna side saw us, and they came over and fetched us, and we completed the expedition. And Vin calculated that we'd walked about 170 miles and climbed up about 25,000 feet and up and down that sort of amount and fallen in 70 crevasses and all sorts of other exciting statistics.
But what, how many
we definitely done it. He calculated about 70, but it also includes when you don't really fall very far,
right,
because proper rope technique, if you really keep the rope tight like you're supposed to, then in fact you probably will fall in and maybe get caught up on your pack.
Yeah.
It's a very scary moment, but you can get right back out relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And we did go in further on a few occasions, but...
And the really impressive thing about this, you all made it, right, in one piece.
Well, we shouldn't have, as I said, first of all, because one person should have died on us from altitude sickness. And then there was a second event where Vin was a little bit too close on, to the edge of a cornice on Mount Hunter. And you never quite know when you're on cornices just exactly where the rock starts.
Yeah.
And the snow gives off, and at what point is it relatively weak? If it's overhanging a lot, there's more weight on the outer side, and it might break much more easily than if it's not overhanging all that much. Well, it so happens that we were on good enough snow that when Vin went through, I was able to get my ice axe in and get him stopped. Or alternatively, if I had not, and conditions for hours along that ridge had been where I couldn't get in a really good stop with the ice axe. So again, when we finally did make the big fall, we were in the right place, or that could have been the end of the trip because it was something like 3,000 feet down to where the base camp is.
Yeah. Huh.
And so anyway, we got away with it. Ended up walking all the way to Talkeetna.
And then in 2000, so you did it in 83, 93, 03, and in 2013, you became the oldest.
What happened was that I started going back, and one of the key things with any expedition is who goes with you and how suited they are for it. And that 83 expedition, we didn't have people with the altitude experience that they wanted. I wasn't selective enough, among other things. And also, I've been doing a lot of stuff with the ski patrol and not so much with the mountaineering club that I could. So I ended up oftentimes being the leader. I would have much rather had somebody with more experience lead me, but I didn't have that privilege after Vin died.
Yeah.
So fundamentally, the people that I chose to go with in 83 were not really up to it, and we didn't get much past 14.
Okay.
So I had an expedition, but it wasn't a successful expedition. Mm-hmm. I had been successful on the mountain twice on the main summit and once on the north summit. So in a way, I'd climbed the summit three times.
Yeah.
Remember, each time takes a day because it's a very, very large mountain. We can argue that it's the largest mountain in the entire world.
Yep.
So, it takes many days. And in a way, that was like three climbs. Anywhere else it would be where you're doing maybe 4,000 feet from a camp, or at least 3,000. So anyway, three times in the very first, and then skipped 70 and failed on 80. So I thought, well, gosh, I'm never going to be able to repeat this. When's it going to happen that I get to stand on the summit again? Well, we were ambitious enough to try another traverse in a different direction in 93. And I had good company on that particular trip, and in particular, we were able to go up the rib, and we were supposed to have two more people meet us. Again, it was a matter of companions, and it turned out that they had gotten into altitude sickness and a little bit of dispute between companions. So when we finally came over across the mountain and tried to go down on the west buttress side, there was nobody to meet us.
Oh, boy.
So we didn't get back down because the traverse took quite a long time until relatively early in the morning. We'd gone right through the night. And so we're arriving at the 17,000-foot camp at about 3 in the morning. And the good folks from Europe who always get up for an early start were out on the road, a German party, among other things. And they're like, you know, what are you doing out here at this sort of hour? And it's like, well, we're coming back down again. You're just starting out to go up. Well, have you seen this party from Alaska? No, we haven't seen anybody, forth. Well, can I sleep in your tent for a little while? No. It's like, oh, well. So we ended up going all the way down, and we ran into some other folks who said, well, we only have a two-man tent, but you guys look awfully famished and super tired. So we ended up with four people in a two-man tent down at 16,000 feet.
Yeah.
But it turned out to be a rather extraordinary trip, even if there had been the usual problem with people getting altitude sick or not being able to get along with each other. And very often when you're doing these big expeditions, it comes down to a logistic problem, a personnel problem, an altitude sickness problem, rather than, oh, I'm a good climber, because Denali's like that. A lot of it doesn't require a lot of technique. And so when I finally got back, I quite often would use purposefully old equipment. And in 2013, when I went back for the 50th anniversary, I dug up some boots that I'd gotten in the Antarctic in 1964. And they had label on them that said 1962. So I purposely put myself in 50-year-old boots, a little bit better than the ones that I had climbed in 1963, and took a lot of other old clothes, because I wanted to demonstrate to the young folks that it's not the gear that really matters. And even though it's getting slightly more technical these days on Mount McKinley, you still, unless you're doing something really remarkably difficult, you could still get on up there with a lot of caution and a lot of time and a lot of patience.
What along those lines, like, what other advice do you have for, let's say, successful trip planning on these kind of expeditions?
Well, the thing that I learned, because we went out in an era that if you forgot it, you didn't have it for a month. There was no way of getting anything into you. The pilots didn't come and whatnot. If you didn't know something about rescuing or taking care of yourself or whatever, you were out of luck, because there was no rescue beacons, there was no satellites. Quite typically, the pilot might come by after a week and look at you, and that might be your very best bet. So fundamentally, you had to be almost over-prepared and think about all the possibilities that could happen. We could have easily gotten in trouble because we were completely unprepared for altitude sickness, and we should have known.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was that we carefully planned our food, and Vin had a lot to do with the planning of the food, but it was largely based on Arctic rather than alpine information. We didn't know enough about it.
Mm-hmm.
We now know, for example, that the pemmicans and things which are really, really good in the Arctic, and they're really quite good up to, say, 10 or 12,000 feet, are totally useless up at 14, 18, 20,000 feet, because if you take things which are fatty, you're getting lots more energy for the weight. So they're really good as long as you have the oxygen to burn that extra fat. Without the oxygen, you can't eat it. It doesn't do you any good. And you go off of the flavor of it.
Yeah.
And you know what happened to us on the first trip? The one thing that was supposed to be in the airdrop that went down a crevasse and we never had was all the sweets.
Oh, boy.
The Hershey bars and the candies and whatnot. And the one thing that I could eat always and never, not get sick of and not wish I hadn't eaten it were sweet things.
Oh, boy.
The quick calories.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't last very long.
Uh-huh.
So they're not a great thing to have, but they're the one thing that seems to work good when you're short of oxygen.
What about advice for like picking partners? And you mentioned that. It's,
well, that's always a tricky one, and yeah. You have to think about it because you're even your daily climbers who are excellent climbers on the rock and whatnot. You don't know anything about them because you haven't spent days in a blizzard in a tent with them when you can't get out.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to live together. And as grumpy as you might get, you have to get along. Well, I'm not that great of a companion, and I've been very fortunate in the cases of being able to stay with people very long, is that they could get me into a mood to make my usual bad jokes or whatever it took to get me out of feeling grumpy. And so I've been blessed on many a sense by being able to find somebody who could handle me when I'm down as well as when I'm up.
That's great advice. Yeah. This is Paul Torlock. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm talking to Tom Choate about his many, many years of climbing and exploring Alaska. I'm sure you've run into many like near misses, and but it's incredible you're still here. So tell some stories about near misses and some lessons learned.
Willie, the thing that I find in a lot of cases is not being well enough informed. Thinking, for example, that you have got something figured out, that nature always seems to have something extra for you. And the other thing is, too, that I grew up in an era where you were supposed to have strong leaders, you know, where men were men and they didn't cry and they did all the leading and they bossed the wives around. And they, in the military, I'd been bossed around by a whole sequence of folks who were supposed to be higher and better than me, whether they were as educated or not or whatever else. And that can put you in a bad situation because unlike the military, you can't stop and discuss, should we go on any further? Is anybody scared?
Mm-hmm.
Especially people my generation. You never admitted when you were scared. I was scared, I won't use the word, when I was shot at in the Army.
Yeah.
But I was supposed to put up with it and pretend that I wasn't scared.
Yeah.
Even a couple of times when I was out hunting, a deer popped up in front of me and I was so nervous I missed. Any other day when I wasn't nervous, I was a good marksman.
Yeah.
So it's like, hang on there. You really need to calm down. You need to discuss things with people. You need to get advice from others. And I was never particularly good at that because I grew up in this bad era when okay, you're the leader, so go and do it.
Right.
And have everybody else follow you. So that's not particularly clever. I'll give you an example. When I was in Colorado in the early days, this would have been 1954-ish. We wanted to climb all the 14ers like everybody else. Well, maybe not all of them, but we wanted to go and do some of the big peaks. And I dutifully read the stories about avalanches and snow and whatnot, and what was known about the avalanches in the 1950s was kind of limited.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like, yeah, you stay away from the cornices and you stay off of slopes of this particular angle and whatnot. And so I did all of those things. And we went up on this big peak in southern Colorado called Mont Blanc. And we thought, it is early in the morning and it has snowed recently, so we will go through the trees. Because avalanches don't go in trees. The trees wouldn't be there if there were avalanches in the trees.
Yeah.
Well, nobody bothered to tell me that in places like Colorado and Utah and whatnot, avalanches can start in the trees. And also that at the bottom of slopes, there's this little pillow of snow that kind of holds it back. So if you should be going along the bottom and in the woods thinking that you're safe, surprise, surprise.
Uh-huh.
And we heard this crack from up above us and looked up, and this 2-foot wall of snow was getting bigger and bigger and bigger and coming our way and right through the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the first time I became what you call these days a tree hugger. I sprinted about three steps to the nearest tree, and I grabbed on as hard as I could. And the snow hit me so hard, it ripped the snowshoes off of my feet. Huh. And I eventually ripped my grip, but at least I was on top.
Uh-huh.
And so I ended up sort of swimming my way down, and my partner was somewhat buried, but not completely lost. His main problem was that he'd lost his glasses, among other things, and whatnot. Huh. And those kind of things happened to me again and again, where I thought I knew enough, and it just was not the case.
Uh-huh.
And that's happened in several other instances, but avalanches is one of the ones that you can never be quite so sure about. Another one is a cornice. Mm-hmm. Well, a cornice is where the snow blows up one side of the mountain and then starts depositing itself on the lee. And sometimes it's making a little curl underneath, and sometimes it isn't. And if the ridge was nice and straight and it was always the same, there would never be a problem. But in fact, ridges go in and out and up and down. But when you look at them in the wintertime, there's this nice, straight, level cornice. Well, what the heck is going on? Where is the rock underneath there? Well, I first learned that on a mountain in Colorado, and then I learned it again on Mount Hunter when Vin went through.
Yep.
Even an experienced guy like him was a little too far away from where the rock was. And this happened to me in Africa. It happened to me in Montana. Quite a lot of places where I thought I knew where the thing was.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't happen. And then after I thought I had it all completely figured out, I went and climbed in the mountains of the moon in Africa. And instead of snowstorms that go on in big blizzards in the winter and form big permanent cornices, it snows every night. And it thaws every day, and it snows every night, and it thaws. There are cornices on those mountains, and they are the most fluffy, unreliable. So I'm trying to figure out where's the ridge and where's the cornice, and I pushed a foot through, and I pulled my foot back out, and I looked down 2,000 feet.
Oh, boy.
And it's like, oh.
Yeah.
somebody tighten the rope, please. Again, I got it all figured out for where there's winter snow, and I did not have it figured out for tropical snow. So again, do you ever learn enough? Do you ever know enough?
Yeah.
Maybe if I'd been smarter and asked the guys that had lived longer in Africa what they thought of the cornice. But no, I was off being the leader again.
Yeah. That's, cornices, they always spook me a great deal. What other lessons or sort of suggestions do you have for someone starting out in this climbing business or exploring business?
Well, these days we have an awful lot of good courses and things. And so it's an excellent idea to spend time taking courses. But I would also advise don't take one course from one person or one school, but get information from several places. Mm-hmm. For example, I learned to belay the California way, where you let slack out. And then I got in situations around crevasses where the more slack that you give out, the more sure somebody is to go out of sight and cause a major accident.
Mm-hmm.
So are there times when you want to make it as short a fall as possible? Definitely. Are there other times when you want to give enough slack? Sure. Well, wait a minute. You learned one way, I got the other way. Another really good example, I've been teaching ice climbing and crevasse rescue on and off for 50 years or so with the Mountaineering Club and other organizations. And it turns out that the more modern way, and this is true of first aid and a number of other situations, is to try to get the person out or the person mobilized or whatever as quick as possible. And I've never been quite sure that that was very good advice.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I see a lot of courses teaching now is how to extract somebody from a crevasse with pulleys and all sorts of things where they're, you get a team of people trying to pull this person out of the crevasse. And I have fallen in lots of crevasses, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I have never, in all of those dozens and dozens and dozens of crevasse falls, had to pull a Z-pulley, getting somebody out of a crevasse. Why? Well, the first thing you do in first aid is to go and see if the victim is okay.
Yeah.
So you set up a line of communication. If the person down in the crevasse is not okay, do you pull them out? Probably not.
Yeah.
I have descended into the crevasse on many occasions, gone down there by myself and scared the person sitting up on top because now there's two of us down the hole.
Yeah.
Stabilized the person down below. Well, now that their leg or whatever is immobilized, how shall we get them out? Do I want to pull them out? They still are probably going to get stuck up at the top.
Yeah.
Well, how about piggybacking?
Yeah.
I've piggybacked people out of crevasses.
Huh.
I've lowered people down a little bit and walked out the bottom.
Yeah.
Pull them out, last resort.
Yeah.
That people have got hurt. They've had their ribs and shoulders pulled off from their hips almost because somebody kept pulling and they were stuck.
Huh. Yeah.
So my advice is the opposite. Go and look. Go down and take care of the situation. Even if it's a little scary for the person on top, don't be in some big hurry to yank them out.
That's right. What, so crevasse falls, cornices, what about for the people who aren't necessarily mountaineers, but I'm thinking just hiking, especially in the Chugach, since we're here in Anchorage talking about Anchorage, and we've done a lot in the Chugach, a lot of ascents, a lot of first ascents, but...
With first ascents, there are a lot of things that you really need to be able to do. And I see today people being extremely reliant on their cell phones, on their idea of getting things electronically. And I have to remind them that, for example, when I was climbing in the Brooks Range, I was 3 weeks with no cell service of any kind, in the early days, without any kind of satellite transmitters or whatnot. It was like those early days on Denali. You didn't have anybody to rely on. You had to figure it out yourself. If your device fails or you don't have enough spare batteries or something with you, what are you going to do? What kind of a backup do you have? Do you know how to use a compass? Can you do a compass and a map? Well, what if the compass isn't in your pack? Do you know how to use your watch to find directions? It's very helpful to think of a backup for a lot of situations that you might be reliant on some mechanical device that doesn't necessarily work. I would advise people in all kinds of situations, whether they be first aid ones or navigation ones or whatever, to learn some backup system in case something doesn't work.
Yeah. That's great advice. As I see people can be more and more reliant on their electronics, and one drop in the water or one... battery that goes bad or something, and all of a sudden you don't have it, and you probably should have a map.
Yes, I remember seeing a person whose telephone fell out of their pocket and went all the way down the mountain into nowhere.
Yeah. There's a lot of stories like that. We're getting sort of close to our end. I am interested in the Chugach a little bit. We could do a whole other show on the Chugach and everything you've done in there. And, you know, bellicose and sunlight and the list goes on and on and on. What's your favorite climb? What was your favorite climb up in the Chugach? Or maybe most memorable?
That's kind of difficult because when you get in trouble on a mountain, it's memorable for certain wrong reasons, but it's something you never forget.
In a good way.
And then in other times, it can be extremely rewarding. Well, one of the things that I kind of like, especially the older I get, is to doing base camps. In the early days, I'd like to do traverses, as indicated. One that comes to mind that was really very sort of special in several ways is when all of the early climbs had been from the west, and each one went a little bit farther. And we went around and set up camp on the east side. And there, a glacier comes down, and we figured out a way to get up through the rocks, and off of the rocks onto the glacier, and then walked up the glacier on that side. Well, it was just the right time of year. Again, it has to be exactly right.
Yeah.
And when we got near the top, the question was, where should we turn? and we ended up splitting into two groups. And it turns out that the one person was not feeling at all comfortable about the scary loose rock, which the Chugach is full of.
Yeah.
And so he elected to wait further down. And I went over and worked my way up through a series of ledges, and I was on my own there, so I had to be really, really quite careful. Got up to the top, got to where I thought this gully was, and I climbed up, got up on the top of the ridge, and the cloud lifted a little bit, and I think there's something a little higher further down. Huh. So I went over to the next little peak, and I stood and looked around, and I wasn't quite certain. And in those days, just to be sure, I took a water bottle with me. Uh-huh. And you lay the water bottle on its side, and you get a level line.
Uh-huh.
So I look down the level line, and I say, that one over there, 60 feet away, is about 6 feet higher.
Uh-huh.
So I went over, and I climbed around on it, built a little cairn, because I decided this was the highest point that I could see. And I started to head back down the way I'd come, rather than go all the way down the ridge where the other two were supposed to be coming up. And I came down, and I heard some noise down below me. And I looked down, and here was one of my companions coming up solo, and he'd gotten stuck.
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, I want to be the first person to have climbed all of these 7,000-foot peaks. Won't you turn around and take me back up to the summit where you went?
Uh-huh.
So like a dummy, I said yes. So I took him back up, and we climbed the high peak, which meant that we'd sort of blown an extra 2 hours.
Yeah.
Got back down, had to go all the way down to the bottom, got down to the lowest part, and of course we ran out of daylight.
Yeah.
So now we have to spend 3 hours shivering.
Oh, no.
Fortunately, you know, we had some extra clothes with us, but not enough to do a proper bivouac. And again, fortunately, the weather wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
So eventually we went down the next morning completed this first ascent. Well, you could argue that it was the first ascent. Certainly the first look at that side. Yeah. Turns out that the easiest way to get to that point that I got to is from even further to the north. The next ascent was over there. But that particular one was extra rewarding because I was able to combine a variety of skills and to sort of calculate which is the way, how to solve this puzzle. Do I go right? Do I go left? Do I go up here and then go over there? Which is, to me, one of the most exciting parts of climbing, is to work out the puzzle. How do you do this? It's, in some ways, it's more rewarding than having a guide saying, this is exactly what you do.
Yeah, that is a great way to end the show, Tom. The whole idea of being outdoors is being able to problem solve and work as a team. Thank you very much for being with us today. This is Paul Torlak with Outdoor Supply Guide. Tom Choate is my guest. Thanks, Tom.
My pleasure.
Thanks to my guest, Tom Choate, otherwise known as the Mountain Goat. A special thanks to our producer, Eric Bort. This is your host, Paul Torlak, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, don't stop climbing, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.